This is the Washington University School of Medicine Oral History Program. Oral History number 55. This is June 7th, 1982. I am Paul Anderson. I'm speaking today with Dr. Francis Otto Schmidt. Dr. Schmidt was born in St. Louis, November 23rd, 1903. He received a bachelor's degree from Washington University in 1924. Thereafter, for 3 years, he was a graduate student in physiology under Dr. Joseph Erlanger here at the School of Medicine. It is this period of his life which is of particular interest to us here. Dr. Schmidt received a PhD in physiology from Washington University in 1927. Thereafter, he was a National Research Council Fellow in Chemistry at the University of California at Berkeley, 1927-1928. He was at the University of London studying biochemistry, 1928-1929, and in Berlin at the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute in 1929. Dr. Schmidt returned to Washington University in 1929 as an assistant professor of zoology. During the 1930s, he advanced to become a full professor of zoology, and in the 1940-1941 year, head of the department. In 1941, Dr. Schmidt joined the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and he has been associated with MIT since that time. He has been chairman of the department, and presently he is Institute Professor Emeritus. Yes. In 1962, he founded the Neurosciences Research Program at MIT. This program functions as a center for theoretical research in many disciplines concerning the brain and its functions. He himself is recognized as a leading researcher in molecular biology. To begin, Dr. Schmidt, first of all, did I make any gross errors in your sketching out your life?
No, that was quite right.
Tell me briefly about your family here in St. Louis.
Well, I grew up in the South Side. My mother was a very good scholar and was offered a four-year scholarship to a college when she graduated from high school, and she preferred, however, not to take it in order to help her father, who was in a business in South St. Louis. She married my father, who was in a similar business at the time, and Mr. Senninger, who was her father, and my father, Otto Schmidt, made a company called Senninger and Schmidt. And they bought a house and a shop and living quarters over it at 3259 California Avenue in South St. Louis. And that served as their place of business when it was expanded to become a wholesale place and then a distributing center. And was quite, did very well. And as a young student, I drove a truck to deliver materials. And I would come home from school, from college, and have a route waiting for me, and I'd come home frequently at 7 or 8 o'clock at night, having finished the delivery route, which made me rather tired to study undergraduate material. However,
so what kind of merchandise did Seneca and Schmidt deal
with? Paint and wallpaper and decorators' supplies and things like that. And when he went wholesale, he would buy the paper by the carload. And that's 50,000 rolls. And they would always select that by going to New York and seeing all the different companies' papers, and then would select what he thought would be a good book. And his tastes were always right on the mark, because they did quite well in it. And so I grew up doing whatever I could to help in this, driving a truck, hoisting paper up in a storage room and all kinds of things like that. But then when my mother died and my father continued to run the business, my sister and her son ran it for a period of years. My father then died at 82 of a massive stroke, and so subsequently my sister decided to sell it, and that was the end of the company.
Well, that's interesting for the business history of St. Louis as well as concerning your career. But when did you first decide to become a scientist rather than a businessman?
Oh, I knew since I was very, very small that I was to be a surgeon. Mm-hmm. And I took the science courses in high school. I did the pre-medic course at the university. And my father allowed me, indeed, gave me a laboratory in the third floor of our place where I had reagents, chemical reagents, and did experiments up there. And enjoyed it. He gave me a microscope, and I started playing with protozoa, etc., etc., so that I was just grooved in science, and I became at the university, in the college, that is, undergraduate, president of a student science organization. Polarized that way right from the beginning. Mm-hmm.
So you had a great deal of encouragement from your family.
Oh yes, and my uncle was a physician. Mm-hmm. And he assured my father that that I would be an investigator and not a practitioner in all probability. And of course he proved to be quite right.
Why did he make that judgment?
His daughter, he had two daughters who received PhDs, one in botany from Washington University, and she married another man who got his doctorate in Washington University. And so this uncle, Dr. Smith, he changed his name from Schmidt to Smith.
What was his first name?
Carl.
Carl,
yeah.
Carl Smith.
Yeah. And he wanted very much to support my career in medicine and in science in particular, and at all times impressed my father with the fact that I should be allowed to continue in any kind of investigative work that I thought I'd like to do. My father wanted me to be a surgeon, and when I finally came to the medical school, it was with the idea of getting an MD for him and a PhD for me.
Mm-hmm.
But my senior professor at that time, Professor Erlanger, told my father that it would be an utter waste of 3 years of my time, precious time at that time, particularly in growing up, to do anything clinical whatsoever. And so my father said, well, he's old enough to know what he wants to do, so perhaps he'll do that. And that's saved me from being a surgeon, and it probably saved a lot of people who are walking around alive today because I decided not to be a surgeon.
But Dr. Erlanger made this judgment upon your enrolling at the medical school?
Oh, no. No. When I got launched, I was doing the regular medical
mm-hmm.
students' work,
mm-hmm.
on top of which I was doing research.
Mm-hmm.
And but he observed what I was doing.
I see.
And
so
I talked over with him the question of this double entendre to be a doctor and maybe even a surgeon, but also to be a scientist.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he was quite right,
mm-hmm.
to advise to forget the clinical business.
So this conversation with Dr. Erlanger when you first began to take your
while I was here, sure.
Your physiology course. Well, that was one question that I naturally came to me, that it wasn't as usual then as it is now to have students doing graduate work in the sciences outside the medical curriculum. Is that true?
Yeah. Well, I am an inveterate investigator. I that's what I live for, in a sense. And at that time, when I came, I started in the immediately he started me out. He had been working on shock during the First World War and had been closely involved in the influence of certain kinds of chemicals to which produce shock, and certain other kinds of chemicals that tend to prevent it. And so he put me on that right away. Mm-hmm. And I started working on that in a big laboratory there up on the fourth floor, south building. And pretty soon Dr. Bishop saw what I was up to and felt that I just needed to get into a laboratory where I would do what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And it wouldn't be shock. And so he got Dr. Erlanger to agree, and I occupied a single room, not out there in the lab, but a single laboratory, all my own. Mm-hmm. And then I really started in working on all kinds of things.
This was also the south building?
Oh yes, on the mm-hmm. fourth floor, right in that group.
Now you're describing a situation that perhaps couldn't possibly exist now. Laboratory space is yeah. quite expensive. the contact between beginning students and senior professors is not nearly so full yeah. as you enjoyed. I'm right in all of these assumptions. I see you're nodding that I'm.
Well, I was
I'm
the only
correct.
Graduate student he had.
Uh-huh. I see that none of the medical students decided to specialize in physiology as he himself had.
Well, there were medical students who worked somewhat in the laboratories, in the physiological laboratories, apart from the didactic work, but none of them were signed up or registered in a graduate school as I was. Mm-hmm. There were not that many in mm-hmm. all the medical school in mm-hmm. 1924. That were literally graduate students at the same time that they were taking medical courses. I took all the medical courses the first 2 years.
I see. Well, I looked on the catalog of the showed all the medical students formerly enrolled, and I didn't see your name. And
I wasn't enrolled as an MD student.
I
was
see.
Enrolled
so
as a graduate student, but I took all those courses.
Uh-huh.
And I could have switched. You see, I didn't want formally to say, I'm going to get an MD and I'm going to get a PhD. Mm-hmm. I preferred not to say that. But mm-hmm. on the other hand, I agreed to take the courses, mm-hmm. many of which were not suited to me, to my needs, as mm-hmm. Dr. Terry, who's head of anatomy, said to me more than once, that human dissection, as the medical students did in those days, was surely not the kind of anatomy that mm-hmm. suited my investigative career. And I agree with him.
This was something that interests me, because you're saying that Dr. Terry had kind of foresight to see that that in a way the gross anatomy was great days were about over, right?
Yeah.
And that he could see that he didn't personally
resist it.
It
was stultifying, actually.
He didn't resist this trend in.
Well, he had little possibility of doing much about it. I feel. Another man who went, there were only three of us who went to the university for a degree before coming to the medical school. It was customary to come down after 2 years of pre-medical work. Mm-hmm. And George Seib, S-E-I-B, was another who did as I did, and he grew up in anatomy under Terry.
Mm-hmm.
And Lawrence Goldman, who was a brilliant student, got into orthopedic work, pediatric work. But died very early.
Mm-hmm.
At any rate, George is still alive, and we talked frequently about anatomy, and Mildred Trotter is still alive, and I talked to her about it, and I think we all agree that it was not a suitable thing for the kind of thing which now now in many institutions, large institutions, medical institutions, enrolls many people in the graduate that are doing graduate work in medical biomedical subjects, mm-hmm. biochemistry. Long was that way. Anatomy was not.
For example, the research done in neuroanatomy.
In neuroanatomy was somewhat better in my belief. Of course, we had a very special man, very good. But still, it was a fairly routine kind of thing that a neurologist would need to know if he were going to do any kind of neurology in his medical career. The wiring diagram. Where did it go wrong? Where is the lesion? And that sort of thing. It had very little in it of dynamics of neuroscience. None whatever. It was purely morphological, and where is this nerve, and where is that nerve, and where does it come from, and where does it go?
Well, if I may pursue a little bit further the relationship between research science, the basic research sciences, and the clinical sciences, I seem to recall that Dr. Everts Graham was ultimately, whether he was this way to begin with or not, I don't know, of the belief that physiology was a very basic part of the training of a surgeon. And in retrospect, did you have looked back and say, well, perhaps Dr. Erlanger was wrong, that there was...
No, because I knew Everts Graham very well indeed. And in Rome in 1932 at an International Physiological Congress, which he attended along with his wife, Helen Graham, sat on the side of a fountain in Constantine's garden and told me what he thought a surgeon ought to be thinking about and doing. Mm-hmm. And a surgeon who knows only how to cut, as it were, without an understanding of the physiology and the whole picture, including pharmacology and all that, is not what he ought to be. And of course, there were people who thought that there were better surgeons in this institution than Everts Graham. I knew that, but. The fact remains that Everts Graham was indeed the top man for very good reasons, and not the least of which was that he inspired others to emulate him in learning physiology and so on. It was because of this flair that he had. He didn't really do very much in investigation and published research and so on until years later when he and his wife Helen Graham smoked constantly, and cigarettes. And I was a member of the National Academy of Sciences when, in those days, the National Academy held fall meetings off the campus at Washington, D.C., at the headquarters of the Academy, and they went to different universities. And it was the turn of Washington University. Our visit was here in November of, I have to think about what year it was. In the 50s. At any rate, and I was appointed to make arrangements out here because they knew I knew the way here. And I did indeed make arrangements for the programs and that. And Dr. Graham there showed his experiments, read a paper on it, in which he was condensing cigarette smoke into the tar that it is, and then painting that on the backs of mice and showing that it became malignant. And with overwhelming statistical evidence. And they had a very nice home at the junction of the Missouri and Mississippi River, and we were invited, Herbert Gasser with it, all of us were invited for dinner, and neither of the Grahams were smoking. Now, Everts Graham was the first to take a lung out of a person successfully. Now, Everts died of a lung cancer. The man whom he saved was at his funeral. And he, in a sense, in the years that were granted him after he realized what was going on, did everything he could in the way of investigation, and we all know now that he was right, and that if it should have been done 20 years earlier.
Well, that is an interesting story. To go back to the question of the relationship of the clinicians and the researchers, or the basic researchers, were there any people that resented your personal, but the kind of investment and money that was, or didn't understand why medicine needed this
Oh, I suppose so. I had no contact with such mm-hmm. people. I, as far as I know, I was working only with people who were yeah. sympathetic to this kind of business.
uh-huh. Well, all the better. Could you describe Dr. Erlanger's laboratories? The kind of equipment, the kind of atmosphere?
Well, Dr. Erlanger was a superb lecturer.
Mm-hmm.
And I know because I was with the medical students, and mm-hmm. I saw what they did, and mm-hmm. I saw what I did. And what we did was we sat there and listened, and he had a person by the name of Elmer who used to help make demonstrations in the little anteroom, and they'd wheel in the dog or the cat or whatever
mm-hmm.
that had the preparation had already been made, which he mm-hmm. would then demonstrate. And we sat there understanding everything he said or thought we did.
Mm-hmm.
And when we went home to write our notes, we didn't know it as well as we thought. He had made it so clear.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I soon learned that I better write my notes nevertheless. at any rate, he was an excellent lecturer.
Tell me about Elmer. I've heard such
yeah,
a person.
Yeah, Elmer.
To
I haven't the slightest notion what his last name
he was on
was.
The
he was
plant department staff?
And oh, yes. Physiology department, yeah.
Uh-huh. And this was the person who helped him
oh,
rig
sure.
some of
well,
the...
Whoever was lecturing, uh-huh. George Bishop or... Artie Gilson or whoever was
uh-huh.
doing a lecture, if they were going to have a demonstration, he would help them.
Uh-huh.
And he was expert at it. He knew where everything was, and he'd cart in the thing, you know, and be right there to help the professor when the professor did something to the animal to show, you know, the recorder would do whatever, and Elmer had to see that everything was working right. He was just a wonderful person that we all liked very much.
Well, just to complete the atmosphere, to look around from where the experiment was being conducted to the students, we have,
yeah.
we can imagine students all very formally dressed. They were
heavens. Certainly as compared with today, they were. We wouldn't dream of appearing without a necktie and a jacket.
Uh-huh.
But otherwise, there was nothing starchy about us.
Uh-huh. I mean, you wore suits rather than laboratory jackets when you were listening
oh,
to
oh, yes, we didn't have any we wore laboratory jackets if we had one
uh-huh.
in the laboratory, yes. And
uh-huh.
especially if we did surgical operation on animals, which we had to do in physiology and in pharmacology.
Well,
but that is what I've been describing is simply the course, the
uh-huh.
coursework. His laboratory is quite another thing.
Well, can you go
I mean
that?
His own personal laboratory.
Can you
oh,
describe?
You bet. I certainly can because I was in the midst of it and saw it develop. Herbert Gasser, who became a very, very close friend of mine, Herbert had come back from several years stay in England and had become very proficient in pharmacological physiology, and he was head of pharmacology, and I took that course and know how he taught. He was a perfectionist. But he and Dr. Erlanger and I suppose George Bishop all agreed that the important thing to do for the sake of neurology, for the sake of physiology, neurophysiology, was to develop an instrument that would be capable of following with temporal and voltage precision and fidelity the action wave, the so-called nerve impulse. And up to that time, they had galvanometers of one sort or another, string galvanometer in the end, and so on. But none of them could possibly follow with fidelity a thing that happened in a 10,000th of a second. It just didn't move that fast. So they were committed, these three people, but it was Herbert Gasser who started it, and he knew how the Braun tube, B-R-A-U-N, the Braun tube was the original German Braun who started and in first made oscilloscope, what we now call the oscilloscope tube, like a TV tube. And so Herbert actually made one, but Western Electric was making, just started to make the same kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they used to buy the Western Electric tube which did all they needed to accept that it had a very small lifetime. And if you put it at 300 volts on the plate, then the image was rather faint, and you had to be in an utterly dark room.
Mm-hmm.
And even then, you had to put the film right directly on the face of the tube.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had to have an instrument which would cause the nerve to be stimulated and swept across the tube precisely in the same way for 20 or 50 times consecutively, because it took that much to expose to get something that made an impression on the film.
And this would be for one exposure,
yeah,
or a series of exposures?
Well, there was a German mechanician in the department who constructed a rotary device which had brushes on it, which synchronized the spreading of the beam across the tube with the firing of the action potential, with the stimulation, with the electrical stimulation, and that caused a wave to appear on the oscilloscope tube. Now, they had to have at least anywhere from 20 to 30 of such sweeps to have enough image intensity to affect the plate at 300 volt plate voltage.
Mm-hmm.
However, if you put it up to 450, which was the maximum, then it was much brighter.
Yes.
And you might even get a single sweep to record. But the tube didn't last very long, and those tubes cost $125 a piece back there in 1920, so 24 or something.
Well, I understand they leased them. Is there
no.
Any?
They couldn't lease them.
No, it was obviously they would just expend the entire...
Oh, sure.
But
then the point is that the three of them did this together,
mm-hmm.
Bishop, Erlanger, and Gasser. And Erlanger did all the dissection. He was fantastically good at dissecting nerves and things like that. Gasser was more or less the mastermind of it. And
was dissection necessary for these early oscillographic?
Well, the nerve had to be dissected from the animal.
I see.
Like a motor root or a sensory root from the spinal cord of a bullfrog.
Wasn't a matter of hooking the electrodes up to the skin of an animal. You actually had to.
The electrode had to be on the nerve itself.
I see.
Yeah.
I see.
At any rate,
is this a matter of it being so primitive, and
because if you let off. Let us say that you want to measure the potential going down the ulnar nerve, which is on the inside of the arm coming from the brachial plexus. Going right along the wrist here is the ulnar nerve.
Mm-hmm.
And if you put an electrode directly on the skin
mm-hmm.
with very high gain, you mm-hmm. might record the action potential.
Mm-hmm.
But it would have gone through all manner of resistance of the tissue in between. The capacity would have changed the shape of the wave and all that, so you had to have intimate relationship with the nerve.
Mm-hmm.
At any rate, the point I want to make was that in those days one did not have vacuum tubes that had any kind of fidelity, stability.
Mm-hmm.
They were very microphonic
mm-hmm.
and low gain. As I remember it, it was a six-stage amplifier. Five or six stage amplifier, and the gain per stage was the so-called mu factor, was only six,
mm-hmm.
six-fold per stage. Therefore,
mm-hmm.
you had to have so many stages, one on top of the other,
mm-hmm.
to take an action potential, which is something of the order of anywhere from 20 to 50 millivolts, and boost it and amplify it to a point that you could put it on the oscilloscope and move that electron beam on the oscilloscope. That would take a volt per millimeter or something like that. That means you really had to amplify several thousands of times. Now, that was so microphonic that the whole amplifier was in a feather bed. There was a biochemist in those days, Eddie West, Dr. West, who was a Virginian and as such liked to shoot. So he had made a shooting range right downstairs there. And to the great annoyance of these three investigators, particularly Dr. Erlanger, Eddie West would bang off with that thing, which would throw everything off.
Well, did they eventually work out a modus vivendi whereby Dr. West had to...
Well, it was a standing joke. Anyway, it was extremely primitive. The place was a fairly large room, about half the size of the room we're in.
Well, let me show you a photograph.
Yeah.
Now, is this of the period that...
That is indeed. No, not quite.
This,
but
would, be
very
a, this
near,
would be a,
very
a later...
Near, yes, this is a later thing.
Later in the
20s, yes,
would you say?
Oh, yes. You see, that oscilloscope was not the kind of thing
we
had. And all this,
That's amplifier. We're pointing now to a picture in the archives of Dr. Erlanger before the a later development of the...
What happened was that the three of them were closely together in this one room.
Mm-hmm.
And it was simply, even this fills a room full of wires and so on. But that room, was the whole thing was devoted to that. There was a little stand there where an animal might be or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
The rest is all equipment.
What kind of animals were used for the experiments?
Rabbits, bullfrogs a great deal for motor root preparations. If they wanted to know what, the Nobel Prize they got was for describing the characteristics of, that is, Erlanger and Gasser, the characteristics of different kinds of nerve fibers. And they found that the velocity of propagation was a function, more or less a direct function, of the diameter of the nerve,
mm-hmm.
also depending on the degree of myelination. If it were a myelinated nerve, it went very much faster than if it were an unmyelinated, but a myelinated nerve is usually a pretty big nerve, going all the way from 2 or 3 microns in diameter to 25 or something like that. And so, by taking an action spectrum, as it were, namely arranging so that all the different waves, alpha, beta, gamma, delta, waves of a myelinated nerve were recorded, one could then say that the velocity of propagation of a nerve of the so-and-so diameter, and they took the very nerve that they were using and had records of, and sectioned it, and spent many, many hours and even days, I can see Herbert Gasser still doing it, measuring the diameters of all these fibers, and then plotting all that out,
mm-hmm.
and showing the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a clear-cut relationship.
Did they have difficulty measuring, considering the development of microscopes at the time? This was pre-electron.
No, difficulty at all, mm-hmm. because they were talking about a division into essentially two groups. One was myelinated and the other was unmyelinated. And then they had come to a firm conclusion that there were four waves, that you distinct waves in a myelinated nerve, alpha, beta, gamma, and delta, depending on the size. And that would go down to relatively small myelinated. But then there was a discovery. By that time, Bishop had left after the success. Then each one split up and had their own. Gasser had his unit, Erlanger his, and Bishop had his. And Erlanger and Bishop continued to work together and knew what each other, what they were doing. Whereas Bishop worked quite on his own. He worked with another postdoctoral student who then joined the staff by the name of Peter Heinbecker. And those two were working quite on their own. And that caused a great deal of trouble, because it turned out that unmyelinated fibers, in other words, very finely myelinated fibers, have a different wave shape than all this alpha, beta, gamma thing. In fact, they, in the end, both groups put together the alpha, beta, gamma, delta, and call that the A wave.
Mm-hmm.
And then they found the B wave, which had B1, B2, and so on. These were very finely myelinated, like a diameter of 1 or 1 micron or 2 microns, something. Then the C wave was very slow, and that was unmyelinated, strictly unmyelinated, very small fibers.
Was it not the case that Dr. Bishop was working with ocular nerves by the time he left?
He was working on the saphenous nerve, but as it happened, he was working on a nerve. Whether he did that by plan or happenstance, I don't know, and I'd just soon not talk about it, but it just so happened that they both groups, came upon, let's use that word, the fact that the original description was very partial.
Mm.
It had to do only with the larger fibers. It gave a valid linear relationship in that group.
Mm-hmm.
But when you got to the finer fibers yet, into the B, and then finally the C fibers, which are very slow waves, centimeters per second instead of 100 meters a second. And as it happens, the kinds of fibers that come in the cerebral cortex, we're all very interested in those fibers there. Many of the most important nerves in the brain are those little fibers. A tenth of a micron fibers, that's 1,000 angstrom units. And so anyhow, when it was all finally resolved, that's how it turned out. And
weren't there also some personality differences that augmented these?
Terrible, yes. I'd just hate to talk about it because they were all such good friends of mine. I might, however, just throw this in, that Dr. Erlanger would not talk to Dr. Bishop, and Dr. Gasser finally did indeed shake hands with George Bishop, and I don't think Dr. Erlanger would do so. And when I came back from Europe in 1929, out at the college, at the university, I started a thing which got to be known as the Verein,
mm-hmm.
B-E-R-E-I-N, and they called it the Schmidt Verein. And I was the cub of the outfit, and therefore I could do anything. I command anybody like Erlanger or any department head, and they all came out when I asked them to come and talk and just tell us what they're doing. And it was a multidisciplinary group. We had Frank Bubb in mathematics and Hughes, head of physics, and biochemistry, Philip Schaefer, and Erlanger and Gasser, and I invited them all.
Mm-hmm.
And for the first time at one of those meetings, Dr. Erlanger and Dr. Bishop met,
mm-hmm.
in a neutral corner.
Mm-hmm.
And they agreed to forget this thing. And it's the first time that they met and did that.
Mm-hmm.
And Herbert Gasser, of course, had in a way made his peace with them before. But it was very, very awkward, and George Bishop was very unlikely to want to bend in the least.
Did he feel in the end that he was cheated in the award of the Nobel Prize?
Sure. He was not a technician.
Uh-huh.
In a sense, he was treated as a kind of a technician. He was, to some extent, more technical by far,
mm-hmm.
than certainly than Gasser.
His own brother called him an excellent carpenter and mechanic.
Well, of course, he's a lot more than that. But I have long since learned that honors and awards are in some ways a snare and a delusion for every person who is given a prize like that. There are at least 8 or 10 that equally deserve it. And in this case, all that did was to cause dissension,
mm-hmm.
in what previously was a wonderfully working group.
Well, they had already, those parted ways long before the Nobel Committee.
Right,
And it was some degree a matter of who reported to whom.
Sure.
There was an argument.
Well, Bishop got out of the department, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Well, these are things.
Well, it's interesting though, because people think and they want to know the truth. You know?
I would like to talk, if I may, about Dr. Erlanger a little.
Oh yes, please.
Yeah. Well, I might, however, go on with your original question about what I did in the laboratories so on.
Mm-hmm.
Having my own laboratory, I did all kinds of experiments on all kinds of subjects, and it was my aim to learn a lot about different subjects. And we had an excellent bacteriologist. No, not bacteriologist. It was Arthur Isaac Kendall. He came down from Chicago and stayed with us here at Washington University only a certain number of years. But at any rate, he was an excellent kind of a cross between a pharmacologist and a pathologist, because he asked me to help him, which I did, and we published together several papers together during that period when I was in my first year, I guess. And I knew how to record things like the contraction of a guinea pig ileum or something like that. All right, so I set up an apparatus in which I would record the contraction of whatever it was, the gut or the uterus or whatever. And it was in a so-called Trendelenburg apparatus, which means it's a little vial with the salt, balanced salt solution, and the tissue is in that. And then I hooked it up with a recording lever, and Dr. Kendall dropped into that reservoir some of the most awful things. Botulinus toxin, gas bacillus toxin, all very, very dangerous things. And of all things, he sucked up the in a pipette this stuff from the brew where he had prepared it. And I said to him, Dr. Kendall, suppose that, you know, you just happen to suck it up in your mouth. And he said, well, it has been done, but it certainly is not something to do purposely. So I learned a lot from Dr. Kendall, of a kind that I never would have learned otherwise. It was just a venture doing something different that I like to do. Now, however, what I did do to a considerable extent was kidney function research with Harvey Lester White. And when I came down, I had come from the university, from the zoology department, where I'd done a whole lot. I had published two papers before I came as an undergraduate in the structure of cilia. And therefore, I had a lot of histological preparations. And Dr. White told me how people were now recording, or rather pipetting, glomerular urine, that is to say, the fluid from the glomerulus of a frog kidney. And this was done by the professor at Pennsylvania and shown at an international congress. Well, he told me about that, and I said, for goodness sake, why do you use a frog for that? Look here. And I got out some of my kit and showed him a section of Nocturus kidney. Just held it up, not even looking at a light at the microscope. And there, along the renal artery, were glomeruli like portholes in a ship, you know, right on the renal artery, and great big things a millimeter in diameter. So we got working together on Nectura, and got so that we could insert the apparatus, the needle, or the tubule. We could then pipette that into another capillary tube, into which we would subsequently then pipette the reagent in order to determine the concentration, etc., etc. So we worked together on kidney function, published several papers, and then I, as a young student, youngster yet, decided to demonstrate this at the International Physiological Congress in Stockholm in 1926. And I must say that my father, you know, when I look back at it, he certainly helped me in many, many ways, though he knew nothing about such matters. And he allowed me to go. I had to pay my own way, of course. And so I, it's a long story, but I tried to get the Nocturi, mud puppies, at the Finger Lakes in Ithaca. And when I got up there, my young lady, whom I married shortly afterwards, met me in New York, and I went up on the train to Ithaca, where the fellow there was catching Nocturi, and he said he'd have an appropriate bucket all prepared and a dozen animals. When I got there, he had three bedraggled-looking Nocturi. It was terribly hot, and no container at all. So we put what I had in the bathtub of the, wherever it was, the pension we were staying in New York, she in her place and I in mine, and the bathtub, when in the morning they were all dead. But fortunately, while I was in Ithaca, I had the presence of mind to call the Battery, at the Battery, which is no longer there, of course, they had a marine aquarium. Uh-huh. And she and I, while we were strolling around in New York, before I made the trip, went into the museum, and there we saw Nectura. Uh-huh. So I went around and spoke to the director, who was a woman, and asked how she kept them and all that, and that I worked on them, etc. But when I found what horrible stuff I got in Ithaca, I got on the phone to that lady,
yeah.
and she said, call me back in 15 minutes,
yeah.
which I did. She said, I can give you two good live Nectarae, and if you want, I can give you two cryptobranchi. Now, cryptobranchus, as the word suggests, has hidden gills, not fluttering gills out, waving them in the fluid. But they also had pretty good kidneys.
Uh-huh.
No, Glomeria were not in a line, but they were all right. Well, anyhow, so she arranged that I should come with a big pail, and I could get it early in the morning because my ship left for Europe at noon. And I went to a hardware store and got two big buckets. And got them. The fellow had orders, and he got them out for me. Well, I went on the Helig Olav, which is a 10,000-ton ship, and it was the hottest day in the history of the Weather Bureau in New York, which was some 90 years, that day.
Uh-huh.
And within one day, all those Nectarae were dead.
Uh-huh.
And I was terribly sad, but the Nectarae were not. And so the passengers got to knowing one as Helig and the other one was Olav, and and they lived on.
Uh-huh.
And so I gave the demonstration. I kept them right with me no matter where I was.
Uh-huh.
In Norway, the captain of the ship took us up to the top of the mountain. I had my animals right with me.
Uh-huh.
And the railroad went from Norway to
Oslo,
Sweden.
Oslo
it was not Oslo. It was at that time. It was
the name of the city.
Yeah,
Christiania.
Mm-hmm. Right. And at any rate, at the border at midnight it was at the border. I was berthing with the head of the physiology department of the University of Pennsylvania, and Herbert Gasser and Dr. Meek were together. Well, at the border we were. The train was boarded by the guard, the frontier guard, and they saw these animals, and they couldn't think of any reason why they should allow such animals into Sweden. But fortunately, I thought quickly and showed them a gilded diploma certificate. Well, the certificate happened to say that I was permitted to take the microdissection apparatus. It had nothing to do with the animal, but they couldn't read English, and so I got the animals in. At any rate, to make a long story short, the demonstration was made. I shouldn't go into all this.
Oh, no, it's a delightful story.
Well, Herbert Gasser was supposed to help me because it was difficult to do the operation. You'd have to anesthetize the animal, put him down on the board, and do the operation without loss of blood. And I started on my own when a kindly gentleman came in and helped me. And we made the preparation work. And I said to him, I'm sorry, I didn't introduce myself. My name is Francis Schmidt. And he said, my name is Rudolf Herbert. Well, I almost fainted. Herber. He was the dean of all physiologists. He was the teacher of Warburg and Meyerhof, and we read his book. It was our Bible in German. It's the Physikalische Chemie der Zellen und Gewebe, the physical chemistry of cells and tissues.
Mm-hmm.
I almost fainted that the great Herber had helped me. Years later, he came and talked to me about that same incident. At any rate, it worked. And some of the top physiologists of the world were there, and Dr. Starling, who was the top man in England, was a kidney specialist, saw it and was so taken by it that he himself did it, took a Nectarae to experiment on the next year himself. So for a young person, and in 1920, 26. I was 22. It was quite an experience because I met so many famous people, and this, to me, was one of the great opportunities of my life. I've been to many of those congresses, and to meet these people, not simply because they're great men, but to meet them under circumstances you really got to know them, you know, and that happened so often in my case, and it meant all the difference to me. At any rate, so I came back. Now that was all, in a sense, by the wayside. I had been doing my medical student work. I had been publishing the kidney stuff with Dr. White. So finally, both Dr. White and Dr. Bishop said, look, you better go to the boss and ask what should be your thesis. After all, you know, and you gotta have a thesis to get a degree. So I went, and Dr. Erlanger thought about it, and then he said, I think it would be nice if you would work on the irritability, excitability of heart muscle. Well, now, it just floored me, because every great physiologist for 100 years had worked on that field. Mm-hmm. What on earth was
he
a person?
Himself, right?
Of course. And, well, I wanted to be married, and to get married required that I have my degree. So I was under very, very great stress in that last year. I did indeed work. I used big turtles and cut the ventricle of the turtle, ventricular strips off of the ventricle, so that the strip might be 10 centimeters long. And I arranged to pass the muscle through a series of vessels, two outside ones and three inner smaller ones with a rubber dam between each one, through which I strung the muscles so that the fluid that was in one vessel would not mix with that in the other. And the idea was to change the ions, what type of ions and what concentration of ions, and to see whether the ionic strength and the kind of ion made a difference on the action potential. Well, I did one experiment after another. Each time there were many. See, there was a rod, a very, very light rod, which connected to a recording lever on each one of those five segments. So there were five records that had to be analyzed, then a timing record, and another record which said when I did something to it. And those all had to be analyzed, which I did at night after supper. And that was really hard work, and I was getting nowhere, really nowhere. And it was very disheartening. And this one day, I had worked all day on it, and getting nothing that I could see was unusual. When Dr. Erlanger, as was usual, came at 4 o'clock and suggested horseshoes. So I didn't see what I had to lose, and we went out and played horseshoes. When I came back, just for luck, I pressed the key again, stimulated, and the impulse went to the first barrier, and I thought it was a complete block, but it wasn't, because the impulse went through after a great length of about a full second delay. And having gone through, of course, it set up the train which went on down to the other parts of the equipment, making each contract in turn. But then it fired back on the initial segment, and we gave that a Greek name, which was opisthodromia, which means to fire, to conduct. Dromio means to conduct, and opistho is return. So that was opisthodromia. And I asked Dr. Erlanger in. He came in, and he saw it, and it did it again. He said, if I were you, I'd stay up all night and get all the data you can. I don't think you'll ever see that again. It's very important. It's very, very important observation. Oh, so I did. And but then I learned, in the end, what it was. The reason that the asymmetry was really not just the ionic differences, but rather a combination of pressure from that rubber dam, which was doing damage to the tissue, as well as the imbalance of ions. And to make a long story short, I got a whole series of experiments. And
how are you recording them?
All on a moving smoke drum. And that had to be shellacked and then analyzed. At any rate, it was very exciting, and I developed a theory by according to which, and I could show it in a diagram much easier than talk about it, but if the impulse in one part of the heart were going to the ventricle, as indeed it does, and if that that section divided into a Y, and the impulse would go down both ends of the Y to the heart muscle, but en route, on one arm of the Y, there was a lesion. And there, it was not total block, but rather what I called monodromia, which means it conducted in one direction primarily, rather than in both directions. All right, but the other arm of the Y had gone beautifully through, had excited the heart muscle. Now the heart muscle, in turn, spread its potential, which fired up into that part of the Y that didn't function, and made it function, and it went through. And having gone through, it went back on the other segment, and it was a reentrant phenomenon. Mm-hmm. And you had the essence of fibrillation. So this turned out to be a model of fibrillation, cardiac fibrillation, and with very good explanation of the whole thing. Well, at any rate, I wrote it up, and it was published in the American Journal of Physiology for 1928. Wrote it up in California after I was married, and almost every year, and indeed even last year, that's 1981. I got and continue to get requests for permission to use figure 3, I think it is, and figure 5, and to reproduce it. Mm-hmm. Now that's over 50 years after it was published.
Uh-huh.
I have never looked at heart muscle again, and I have never had such requests from anything else that I have ever published. And here was, it all came about from horseshoes, you see.
If I were to look in the Science Citation Index, I would probably still see some references to it being quoted. Just briefly, you mentioned the horseshoes, and this was Dr. Erlanger's favorite sport, and yet...
Well, George Bishop and Eddie West and I did it, and we worked hard and created two horseshoe courts with sand and enclosures and so on, and the pegs were running parallel with the building that connected the old south and north building.
Refectory building.
Yes, and it was parallel that. In other words, parallel to Euclid. And I got two headlights from my father's old cars and put it on the fourth floor seminar room, so that at night we could play horseshoes after a meeting. Just turn on the lights, and they we were nuts about horseshoes. And Dr. Erlang, you see, we had been playing for some years.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, clinicians used to come across the street from the clinic, and they would clean us out. They were very good horseshoe players, and
they had developed that.
they were better than we were, but we had a lot of fun. And then Dr. Erlanger got into it, and I might say that another little anecdote. I had to take an examination, of course. The thesis was finally finished and on time, submitted to the graduate school just about on time. And I was something of a nervous wreck, trying to get it all done, and Dr. Erlanger corrected everything as I produced sections. He would take it home and correct it, and in the morning bring it in, and my spirits sunk every time I saw what it looked like. It was all scratched up. And I would ask, Miss Steubinger was his secretary, I would ask Dr. Erlang, I'm sorry, I don't understand, what is this that you've written? He'd look at it, and in some instances he couldn't read it, so Miss Steubinger could, and she could read it. And and he was so good about it, but he was such a perfectionist. I learned how to write scientific documents from Dr. Erlanger. It was starchy, to be sure, but precise. And finally mine got written to his satisfaction. All right, so we had to go out to the campus for the examination. And I was warned by Bishop. He said, you've been pretty cocky, and we're going to take it out of you today. And they did. But the examination went on for 2 hours or more. And It was a fairly large board. And I thought, reasonably well, but the last question that was asked was by Dr. Schaefer, head of biochemistry, and he said, Mr. Lindbergh has been over the ocean now for over 30 hours. Would you tell this board the physiological and biochemical processes by which he manages to keep awake? And if I had wanted to be rude, I would have said, look, I'm fighting like that myself. I managed to say something which I'm sure wasn't very good. But then the ordeal was finally over, and going back, of course, there was celebration because it was over. The damn thing was done. And so we went and played horseshoes. Uh-huh. And we were busy playing horseshoes when somebody rushed out of the north building, and said, Lindbergh has landed in Paris.
Oh,
so I know when I finished my exam.
Everybody knew that the flight was in process, progress?
Sure, you bet. Uh-huh. Spirit of St. Louis, after all.
Uh-huh.
So.
What sort of man was Schaefer?
Schaefer was a professor of biochemistry and an excellent biochemist who got into the insulin game very early.
Uh-huh.
And worked more or less, he was a carbohydrate chemist, and he very early got into the question of insulin, and there were big discussions. I remember very well that at one of the discussions, big open seminars to the public, my professor at the university, Dr. Caswell Gray, being something of a philosopher, asked the question, now if it's true that these people with diabetes are going to be saved by your injections of insulin, they will have children, their children will have children, and they're all going to be diabetic. Now is that a good thing to do or isn't it? Well, of course, everybody knew the answer, and it's the only thing you can do. And so I grew up more or less, and Dr. Schaefer was a very close friend of mine, and he helped me on many occasions, as did Dr. Gasser, who was head of pharmacology. And
so you got along equally well with Dr. Gasser?
Oh, very well indeed. But my wife, whom I was to marry, was an excellent pianist.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we came back from our second postdoctoral year in Berlin in 1929, settled down out at the university, and I as an assistant professor, she bought his piano, which was a beautiful Steinway reproducing grand, Aeolian reproducing grand. And you could buy records. And many times he had parties in which he called them Roman parties because everybody roamed around at his apartment. And he did a pharmacological experiment on my wife, had her play the minute waltz. And and she used to play, I think, faster than probably she ought to, but she was a very good pianist. Then he clocked it. Then he asked her to please take a martini, which she did. And in those days, we weren't quite that used to cocktails. And played it again.
They may not have been legal, as a matter of fact.
Right? yes, you're right.
That's right. Volstead Act had not been repealed. No wonder you weren't.
That's right. That's right. The clinicians used to, the interns used to, and the residents used to come and pinch alcohol from Ronzoni, who was Mrs. Bishop, and she ran the service lab in biochemistry. She had alcohol, so she put some ipecac in it for the devil of it. It wasn't so pleasant for them. Well. So there.
It's a very interesting. You mentioned Dr. White.
Yes.
What sort of person was he?
He was a man who was a pragmatist, a person who thought very deeply. He read Greek and Latin to a degree. He was very interested in formal philosophy. He tried to reason things out, and by reasoning things out, I don't mean just physiologically. I mean all kinds of social matters and so on. And in many ways, he was a very fine person in that regard. We worked together very closely. We went to demonstrate the kidney function in Nectaris on a very bitter cold winter in my little two-seater car. And, well, that's a long story. But the animals almost froze in the back of the car. We had to take them inside the car, or they'd be dead, just frozen. Uh-huh. And it took a long time. And in Ohio in those days, there were crosses where any fatal accident happened.
Uh-huh.
And it started to snow heavily. So we got to betting when we saw a bad hill or something, how many crosses would be at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
The chances are that we were looking more for crosses and all that at the side of the road than watching our business, but mm-hmm. we managed to get through.
You were headed to Columbus?
To Cleveland.
To Cleveland.
Yeah. And we made it to Columbus and stopped the night. There's no sense going ahead. At any rate, he had a brew of some kind. It was some very potent, like gin, I guess, something like that. I never drank that kind of stuff myself, but he had it in the back of the car. And I, by God, really, I drank it with him because it was cold. And that was so he and I were on many expeditions. And, well, Harvey Lester worked together with me on more than science. And in the end, of course, he took over as head of the department. I was offered that job, but I had already gone to MIT and did not feel... to succeed Dr. Erlanger would have been a great pleasure and a privilege, but I just had so well in Boston that I couldn't mm-hmm. possibly consider it. Harvey took it and became head of the department.
How about Carl Corey? You wrote at least one publication with him.
Oh, yes,
him.
Sure.
What can you tell
Carl's
me about?
Now 85, you know, and still mm-hmm. reasonably good.
You're in contact with him?
Oh, yes. He and Gertie Corey, you bet. And I was working on nerve, of course, and I wanted to know whether when one stimulated nerve, the glycogen increased, or the lactic acid increased or not under conditions of anaerobiasis, which means removal of all oxygen or put the nerve in carbon monoxide, which I learned from Dr. Professor Warburg in Berlin. And I worked with Gasser on the same subject using carbon monoxide, 98% carbon monoxide plus 2% oxygen. In that case, the nerve would fail and fail to conduct, and the curve of excitability would go down slowly to zero. And then, without changing the partial pressure of the carbon monoxide or anything else, you simply illuminated the nerve. Well, Dr. Warburg had gotten the Nobel Prize for using that technique because he had proved that when you illuminate the binding capacity of the oxygen for the biocatalyst was much less in the presence of light than it was in the dark. So without changing anything, the action potential came right back. And we followed it. And you turn off the light, and you, in a sense, turned off the excitability, and the curve plummeted again to zero. And Gasser and I published two papers on that. We worked together on it. This would have been in the early 30s. And so I worked with also with Helen Graham on the same kind of thing, but with Carl Corey to find out if there were lactic acid produced under these conditions.
Mm-hmm.
And he found that there was not.
Mm-hmm. And so you set up the conditions for
yes,
the experiment,
and
then
he did
the analysis.
Did the analysis, which is pretty high-powered analyst, I'd say.
Yes. Well, we've alluded to Helen Graham. How was she to work with?
Great. We worked together. What happened was that we were working on what were called slow potentials. We'd found that if instead of using oscilloscope to measure relatively fast potentials as they move from one part of the body to another, instead of that, if you measure the slow change of polarization of the nerve membrane, by slow, I'm not talking about milliseconds or even seconds. I'm talking about minutes and hours. And if one had what was called a really good non-polarizable electrode, so that the electrode at least didn't cause polarization changes, one could follow the change of potential by balancing the potential in an apparatus, a voltage divider, and keeping the oscilloscope at zero. Now, as the potential changed, that would move from the point in the middle of the tube, and you would balance it and measure the voltage. In that way, we measured potentials that lasted for hours, steady potentials. And those were potentials that I discovered were oxidative in nature. That is to say, they involved oxidative processes, whereas fast potentials were much more efficient and so on. So she and I worked together on a number of those things, and very cordially indeed. She smoked, of course, very much.
let me throw out another name, Victor Hamburger.
Oh, Victor. Well, Victor, you see, came on. He escaped from Germany. He was a student of the Nobel laureate in that field in Germany.
Hans Spemann,
and came to Canada first, and he came to our lab from Canada, and was the junior assistant professor. I was junior assistant professor till he came, and then I went up in the ranks, and so did he. But Dr. Grave, the head of the department from Hopkins, of course, set aside every Thursday night for what he called philosophical discussions, and he was used to that from Johns Hopkins, and all the graduate students participated and all the staff, and they had to be there at 7 o'clock or 7:30, I think it was 7, and Dr. Grave was the master of ceremonies, and somebody was told off to read. We started a book of some sort, and it was usually a very provocative book. And so somebody, a graduate student or a staff member, and he reported on it. And then there was general discussion. And in this general discussion, there was desserts, you know. And it was during these discussions that Victor and I went at each other. He was not a physiologist, nor a chemist, but he was an excellent biologist and an excellent student of growth and development, which I knew very little about. So we were very, very friendly, but we certainly had some pretty animated discussions. And it went on like that until when Dr. Grave retired, I took over, and Victor then handled all that part of the curriculum, and then after I left, of course, he took over. And I'm happy to say that an F.O. Schmidt lecture series was begun at MIT some 6 or 8 years ago, 10 years ago, and Victor gave one of those lectures, and it was just marvelous. It was great. And I understand I was out there. Our meetings are right across from the campus there, but of course he wasn't around, and whether I'll get to see him this time, I don't know, but he's still excellent, in good condition.
Well, you returned to St. Louis just in time for the Depression here.
Exactly.
And being a researcher, needing money for experiments and so on and so forth, were there really great problems, that this
you
economic
bet,
problem?
Yes, there certainly were.
How can you describe
well,
some
I can,
problems that
yes,
you encountered?
Well, the question was, what kind of work shall I do? I obviously could not do oscilloscopic work. I had no expensive equipment of that sort, nor did I, at the moment at least, want to do that. But I did want to do respiratory work of the kind that I learned from Meyerhoff and Warburg, and do work on nerve respiration and the biochemistry, or rather metabolism of nerve. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Ronzoni was good enough, to, Mrs. Bishop, to lend me some of her equipment, and my brother, who was 10 years younger than I was, and helped in making the apparatus work. And he invented a tube later on for a thermostat, and that kept everything going. And so we got working on it, doing the effect of carbon monoxide on nerves, and it turned out that if you put carbon monoxide on them and then illuminate them in the bath while they're shaking, in the thermostat bath while you're reading the manometer, the respiration comes back, does indeed, just like the action potential did, etc. Now, I started in that kind of thing. However, I learned the value of a technician when I was in Germany. A good technician is a wonderful thing to have.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was just at this time that the man who later became vice president of the Rockefeller Foundation for Medicine, Warren Weaver, came through and saw what I was doing and gave me a grant from the Rockefeller Foundation for $10,000.
Mm-hmm.
That made it possible for me to hire a technician.
Mm-hmm.
It made it possible for me to do a number of other things which you wouldn't believe, but things were so cheap in those days.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what really set me up, was that $10,000. I've told Warren Weaver many times during his life how much that meant to me.
How long did that last?
The technician stayed on more or less indefinitely. He was there even when I left. And we got funds after that. We succeeded in getting funds because I had been publishing research.
What kind of other sources were available?
Well, the Rockefeller Foundation itself
mm-hmm.
Continued, and indeed then later when I went to MIT, they gave, $75,000 to buy the first electron microscope in this country, and I was to find out what there was to electron microscopy. We had the first electron microscope in this country when I went to MIT, and that was Rockefeller.
Uh-huh.
But that was a special grant. They gave us $500,000 on one occasion and supported our work in general, and he had got used to supporting the work.
The federal government hadn't entered the picture at this time.
No.
During the 30s, you did experimentation with applied X-ray diffraction and polarization optics.
Exactly. Now, yes, exactly. Now, I can tell you something very graphic. It's this, that in 1923, I was still an undergraduate. I went to the Marine Biological Laboratory in the summer. They gave summer courses.
This is at Woods Hole.
At Woods Hole. And the department awarded me a fellowship for that purpose. But there was only $75 available, and then Dr. Hansen had his candidate, so they split it, and I got $37, and so did his the candidate get $37 to go to Woods Hole for 6 weeks. And it happens I went on then for another 2 weeks with Robert Chambers. Anyway, so my father, of course, was asked to support this venture, which he did. Now, at Woods Hole, I witnessed what I like to refer to as the Battle of the Giants, because Thomas Hunt Morgan, who after all gave the name Gene, and who got the Nobel Prize for his work on Drosophila genes, which are banded, chromosomes are banded, and set out the gene map with relation to particular bands, knowing that one gene was associated with this band and with that and the other. And all his gang was there, Sturtevant and Bridges and so on. And they had, I'll never forget it, a debate, in a sense, in the old lecture hall, an old wooden lecture hall at Woods Hole in the evening. And Morgan and E.B. Wilson the top cytologists of the day, McClung and one or two other. McClung, of course, was a great developmental biologist. And they, on the one hand, being morphologically and genetically oriented, and a man by the name of Jacques Loeb, on the other hand. And Jacques Loeb...
Brother to Leo Loeb.
Yes.
Of this.
And, yes, Leo was not a physiologist, biochemist, like Jacques was. At any rate, he had a little shack close to the Eel Pond, and I went in as a young student, I was 19 at the time, watched him doing experiments on measuring the osmotic pressure of proteins, and he proved that this old gag about colloids, and everybody ascribed living things to this strange colloidal state, which did magical things. And he made it clear in a book that he wrote then on the basis of that work at Woods Hole, of what's called the colligative properties of solutions, which says that a molecule, the osmotic pressure, and it turns out a number of other properties like that, is proportional to the number of molecules there and not to the size of them. And in other words, a protein may have 1,000 formal charges, positive or negative, but that doesn't make that it's still an electrolyte, like salt is, like sodium chloride, and nothing magic about it. Well, anyway, he tore into these people who were talking about the gene. You see, if you know the length of a chromosome, along a chromosome, in which there are a certain number of genes, you divide one by the other, and you get the average size of a gene, which turned out to be about 100 angstroms, and their view was that it was some little ball, a string of little balls like that. I talked to Bridges, actually, and Bridges said, you see, they're cross-striated like muscle. And he wondered whether maybe the structure would be like muscle. I happened to be, I knew a lot about muscle. I'd worked on it a good deal. I assured him that I didn't think it was like muscle at all. In other words, they were pretty naive about chemical matters, these people. And so it was clear to Jacques Loeb that they never advanced the field, literally, by the kind of formalisms that they were indulging in. You would advance the field of genetics, indeed, as they did, and probably developmental biology and certainly morphology, but not a real knowledge of an understanding of what's going on. And in other words, this was my awakening because at Woods Hole, because it was clear to me that you must know how to describe things. The important things that you need to know are at the molecular level. That was the point. I became, in short, a molecular biologist. I was awakened to all kinds of things. In Merkel Jacobs' class in physiology, for the first time, I heard of an electron as being involved in oxidation-reduction reactions. I knew they chased around in iron wires, but I didn't know that they, the whole world was opening up.
And this, to repeat, was while you were an undergraduate.
Yes, I was a junior, just at the end of my junior year. You were supposed to be graduate students, but I got in as...
And then this was applied to your thinking much
right,
later?
Right, I became a molecular biologist, in a sense, right then and there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as such, to deal with molecules, I began trying to see how one would do it. And it was clear one had the slightest notion of any electron microscope at all in those days. And one knew that the limit of resolution of a microscope using light was 1/2 the wavelength of that light, which would mean that the smallest thing you could ever really see would be about 1,500 angstroms in diameter, which is, of course, not molecular at all. So it turned out that I read a book by a German by the name of Schmidt with a DT, W.J. Schmidt, on it's called Die Bausteine des Tierkörpers in polarisiertem Lichte, which means the structure of animal tissues in polarized, analyzed by polarized light. And he was a very good, he knew his optics. And that book, I read that book very carefully, and then the book he read, he published subsequently in 1937. And in short, I knew how to analyze the structure by use of polarized light. And a French paper had appeared also, which gave fancy names to it, like smectic and nematic and so on. Fluid crystals, I learned about fluid crystals also. Well, in short, the molecular biology, when I came to the medical school, I had knowledge about those things,
mm-hmm.
and wanted to. In fact, I gave a triple department seminar as a young, just arrived as a young student,
mm-hmm.
and talked about the field, which nobody understood at all, of course, because it is a specialty, and the whole field of polarization optics, and then X-ray diffraction,
mm-hmm.
and by X-ray diffraction, I was determined that I should do X-ray mm-hmm. diffraction. And indeed, coming to this medical school, to a degree, of course, it was Erlanger that attracted me, but also another thing that attracted me was the willingness of Sherwood Moore, who was head of radiology, to let me have an X-ray tube.
Mm-hmm.
And he let me have a place where I could work on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I did indeed set up a diffraction outfit down there. And I got diffraction patterns of salt. But indeed, that's all I could do, because this was a tungsten tube, like a therapy tube, with a wavelength of 0.2 an angstrom. Very much shorter than I needed. I needed a wavelength of near a copper tube with a wavelength of about 1.5 angstroms. And so what Moore gave me helped not a bit, but it decided that I'd come to this medical school.
I see. So,
because
so
Philadelphia... You see, University of Pennsylvania, Dr. Merkel Jacobs, who's head of the thing at Woods Hole, had singled me out in a way, and I guess he had convinced them at Penn to offer me a very good fellowship, $1,200 a year, which in those days for a young guy was really very good.
In a word,
I turned it down to stay here.
Your investigation of the X-rays was deferred.
It had to be until later.
Mm-hmm.
When I was back out here in the university.
I see.
And as an associate professor, I guess, or something like that. And then I got really going into it, and since I had no tube, I made regular trips to Urbana, where Dr. Clark had a good X-ray diffraction unit, a copper tube. And I went on Friday, complete with animals, frogs, cats, lobsters, and stayed till Sunday night getting X-ray patterns. And then Dr. Baer, Richard Baer, who went along with me to MIT then, got into it also, and we did X-ray diffraction together. And I learned X-ray diffraction along as he did together. And we developed what is called small angle diffraction. And that means to say that we could detect very large repeating periods. Not like, you see, the distance between atoms, as in water, is about 1 angstrom unit. And this was, we found a diffraction of 171 angstroms in the radial direction in the nerve myelin. And that was a big spacing. And together with polarization optical analysis, we were able to derive an understanding of the structure and orientation of the molecules of that myelin. And that turned out to be a model of all cell membranes, because that's what myelin proved to be. One of my students, Dr. Guerin at MIT, discovered that, the so-called wraparound theory of myelin, which is correct.
Mm-hmm.
And so then, after all these trips, we'd take enough pictures that when we came home, it would take us another month or more to analyze mm-hmm. them. We'd go on another trip, and get some more data. And then a chap who was from Caltech came as a postdoc with me, as a research associate of sorts. And he built an X-ray tube.
What was his name?
Palmer.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Palmer, very slowly, built and constructed an X-ray tube. So I had an X-ray tube right here at at Washington mm-hmm. University.
So this would be by 1932-33?
No, it was nearer to the time when I left. It was about 1938 mm-hmm. and 9 and in there. Mm-hmm. And we did a lot of crucial work.
But
work was done in the 38 and 39, published in the early 40s.
Diffraction and polarization optics was your major research interest in the 30s.
It had to be. That's all there was.
Mm-hmm.
And then came this offer to for an electron microscope. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, at MIT, I got that going, and Dick Baer had come along, and he was set up with a small-angle X-ray equipment. I saw to it that all that was provided. And we started in working in collaboration, he with X-ray diffraction and I with electron microscopy and polarization optics, when an influx of young doctors, MDs primarily, joined our group as postdocs.
Mm-hmm.
And I just came from a conference out there in which some of those postdocs...
Well, electron microscopy became an important part of the research program here.
Well, yes, of course.
Dr.
Sure.
Dempsey
and
others.
Yeah, sure, you bet.
Just one brief question. Much more recently, you exchanged information or worked with Dr. Robbins in psychiatry. Eli Robbins?
Oh, yes, yes.
And this involved protein?
Proteins, brain proteins, right.
Mm-hmm.
And through him, I got to know Moore. And Moore has discovered several proteins, one of which he calls S100.
Mm-hmm.
And another one is 14-2. He has some very empirical names on it. But S100 became very well known. It was thought to be nerve-specific. Now, he came out and gave a lecture at our place in Boston, and I had arranged that an excellent immunologist should be there from Brandeis. And the immunologist said, if you will give me some of that protein, I'll make an anti-serum to it, which both of them did. And that anti-serum went round the world very quickly to Tokyo, to all around Budapest. And people were able to apply an antibody to discover whether or not S100 existed in this or that or another nerve or preparation. And so that's correct. Now, when I think back on that, it seems so incredible, because at a Woods Hole, we had a week-long session at Woods Hole last May, and it was on molecular genetic, the impact of molecular genetics on neuroscience. The book is to appear next month, called Molecular Genetic Neuroscience. There were 39 speakers and chapters in it.
I'm truly sorry to interrupt at this time. This is the end of our tape and the end of the interview with Dr. Francis O. Schmidt. Thank you very much, Dr. Schmidt.